Listen online or download from the RN website.
On RN, online, or on your mobile phone, thanks for joining me for Big Ideas. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. Huntington's disease is a hereditary neurodegenerative condition for which there is no cure. Symptoms include uncontrollable jerky movements, a decline in cognitive function and memory. It's accompanied by anxiety, depression, lack of inhibition, and aggression. As it worsens, those with the disease become rigid in posture and may have difficulty chewing, swallowing, and speaking. Bridget Lyon and Jeff McDonald have made a powerful and confronting documentary, The Inheritance, about a family struck with the genetic curse of Huntington's. Not just any family, mind you, but Bridget's own family. Her grandmother had Huntington's, meaning her mother, Judy, had a 50-50 chance of also having this dreadful disease.
I always knew about the risk of Huntington's disease because of my parents' attitude that they shouldn't hide anything from their three children. Meanwhile, scientists had been hard at work, and in 1993, the gene for Huntington's disease was found after 10 years of searching.
When Jude was tested positive for the disease, I was just crying my eyes out. It was a tragedy to know that this disease could be possibly passed on to your children.
Genes are made up of four chemicals that are represented by the letters A, C, G, and T. What the scientists had found was remarkably simple. On the top of chromosome 4, the parts are spelled C, A, G. Everyone has this gene, but people who have Huntington's disease have too many repeats of C, A, G in theirs. That's what the genetic test tells you. How many CAG repeats you have. Mum has 43.
Particularly over 39, people would tend to develop Huntington disease.
Anyone who has an expanded gene has a 50% chance of passing on that gene anytime they have a kid.
After some years of living in the UK where my brothers Nick and Warwick were also living, I settled in Sydney. And by 2003, I found myself in love and unexpectedly pregnant. I'd been so sure I would find out my gene status before bringing children into the world. But Jeff and I found termination wasn't an option. After our beautiful boy was born, I quickly had the test. I was thinking I'd be let off the hook, that they would say, "You don't have Huntington's," and I'd go around cheering, and everything would be lovely. But it wasn't. I too would dance the wretched dance.
And we all fall down.
That's Bridget Lyon, narrator and co-director of The Inheritance, which follows the heartbreaking decline of her mother from Huntington's and reveals, as you just heard, the fate of her and her brothers. Tasmania has one of the highest incidences per capita of Huntington's in the world, and last month, at the Breath of Fresh Air Tasmanian Film Festival in Launceston, where the film screened, I spoke to Bridget and Jeff about it. They are partners in both work and life, and they have two children, one of whom may or may not have had the Huntington's gene passed on to him. How hard was this film to make? It is an incredibly intense film, and Bridget, you're really one of the chief subjects of the film. How hard did you find it to make and to be the subject of?
It was a long stretch making it. What was great was because it was us, we could just keep editing it, which is an incredibly powerful thing to be able to do, because you can just make it until it's what you want it to be. The making of it was just a matter of hanging out with my mum and dad, really, and you know, that was a bit difficult. There was the interviews with the experts and stuff, but mostly it was, you know, a process that we're used to, and we had a lot of test screenings where we tried to balance the film so that people could watch it and walk out of there with a sense of something other than horror. Because what I found when I told people usually about the film is that they get kind of freaked out. I mean, when I tell them about Huntington's, they get kind of freaked out and they can't actually process the information that once you have the gene, once you know you have the gene, you've got 100% likelihood of getting the disease. People don't don't understand that. They can't process that. And also when I tell them that it's 50% chance you'll get the disease, but out of three siblings, we've all got the gene, that also freaks them out. And so what's great is they watch the documentary and they come out of it glad that they've been able to understand this thing.
So just to clarify that, if your parent has Huntington's disease, if your mother has Huntington's disease, you as the child have a 50% chance statistically of getting that gene as well, and if you have it, you will definitely get Huntington's disease.
Yeah, that's right.
And the 50% figure is obviously an average figure, because as you just said, every sibling of yours has the Huntington's gene.
Yeah.
Gee, that's a really tough roll of the dice, isn't it?
It is. People who don't have the gene, sometimes if they have the test and they find out they don't have the gene, they get what's called survivor guilt, which is a real thing. And I just tell them, actually, I'm sorry you have the guilt, but what is really great is that there'll probably be someone, you know, you'll be there for your brothers or sisters, and that's actually a really important thing. That's probably what freaks us out the most, is that we're all going to go down and there'll be no one.
This is not any film. This is a film, A, about your mother's decline as a result of Huntington's, and this is a film during which you find out that you have the Huntington's gene and that you then become a central focus of the film. How hard was that emotionally for you to be involved in capturing on film? And I'll ask Jeff to give a response to it as well after you've answered.
Actually, Jeff will be able to give a really good response to this, because he's the one who has to pick me up off the floor when I have little crying sessions or anxiety problems.
So I suppose the question to you then, Jeff, is how emotionally hard was it for you to film your partner through this unbelievably life-changing time in her life?
It's difficult, but it's also quite empowering. It's better than not being able to do anything. So if you're being on board with Bridget, helping her do something, educate people, empowered me. I actually felt, I felt useful. I felt like I contribute to something that Bridget really is passionate about. The hardest thing was watching Bridget some days fall over and having to watch. The realization that Bridget suppresses a lot, you know, as you would, is that I'm going to get it. And watching your own mother every day with the symptoms was a lot for her sometimes, obviously.
The film doesn't sugarcoat the message, so I suppose I probably shouldn't sugarcoat the questions, really, in
no,
a sense. You are filming the steady decline of Bridget's mother, and in the back of your mind, surely, is that Bridget too will get this disease. How does one deal with that knowledge? Do you get on with life?
I'm sure. I think about it, but I'm just a get on with it person, and you can't let those things drag you down. You can't let them stop you doing what you want to do. Also, Bridget's dad's quite inspirational, as you'd see in the film.
Certainly.
Bridget's mum and indeed her family are very fortunate to have him. And I draw a lot of strength from what he does. So, but yeah, you know, you don't know what's going to happen in your life. So why bother worrying day to day? You just got to make sure each day is lived well.
Well, that's what they say, and I suppose if you're able to live your life that way, that is absolutely the way to go. Bridget, can you describe for those who haven't seen the film, which will be most of my audience on Big Ideas, the history of this disease in your family and also when you found out about it?
I actually heard a great quote yesterday that I really liked about just what you were talking about, which is a couple in the audience said that when they found out that they had Huntington's in their family, and someone said, or they looked it up on the internet and it said Huntington's is always fatal. And they said, but life is fatal, which I thought I quite liked.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, so my mother looked back, researched our family tree actually, and she found a great, 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 great grandmother who died in the lunatic asylum in Aberdeen in 1857. And we rode away to them and got the notes, which said that she was suffering from hallucinations and of witchcraft and wealth, which seemed to point to Huntington's, I think. Hallucinations being one of the symptoms often, and said that she was always agitated. So she had a son, James, who immigrated to New Zealand, And then he died crossing a river about the age of 45, so we're not sure. Maybe he slipped because he had Huntington's, we're not sure. He had a son called William who was diagnosed by a doctor out from Scotland around 1950, who'd recognised the disease from Scotland, but the family was never told. His daughter, Mavis, is my grandmother. She died of Huntington's disease, but my mum didn't know that it was Huntington's until she'd had us three children. And when she went to the doctor when I had nappy rash, apparently, she would always tell me, the family doctor told her that Mavis had Huntington's disease. I'm not sure why he left it to that point. I'm not sure why it wasn't spoken of. And then, yeah, my mum she had a genetic test when it was first available. In the early 90s, a genetic test for Huntington's became available, and she had it in 94. And she found out that she had the gene. Up to that point, I had a pretty good chance of not having Huntington's. And after she'd had the test, I then became 50% at risk.
So she told you immediately she found out? She told the family that...
She did, yeah. Mm. She was really open about Huntington's.
And you were about 21 at the time?
I was a baby when she found out that her mother had it, yeah. Or when she found out that she had the gene,
yep,
that she was 100% likely to get the disease, I was 21, yeah, in 94.
As you've already told us, all of your siblings have the Huntington's gene. Was not having the test ever an option for you?
Yes, I was happy to bumble along, but it was the fact that I met Jeff and we got pregnant, a surprise pregnancy, and we then were confronted with this whole thing, and I'd kind of promised my mother that I wouldn't have any children with Huntington's because there are ways, you know, IVF, you can use IVF to have children without Huntington's. So we were in a situation where we had to work out what to do. So we had some genetic counselling and we decided to continue with the pregnancy. Mm. So we have one child who's 50% at risk of having Huntington's, and our second child is IVF using a process called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. So he doesn't have the gene. And if you don't have the gene, you can't pass it on. Mm. So the line's finished with our second son. Our first son has to deal with everything.
Yep.
Everything that I've had to deal with.
And that will be his decision to make when he grows up, presumably.
Whether he has the test or not, mm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
When he has the test, if he has the test.
Yeah. There's lots of people who don't. I think our family's just a little bit... We're just kind of a little bit like that, probably because we're all pretty similar, because we're a family. Actually, one of my brothers didn't want to have the test until Mum had passed away, because he didn't want her to know. But in the end, his situation became that he had to find out just because he wanted to have children as well.
Mm. And this is all captured on film, isn't it?
It is,
this
yeah.
Incredibly life-changing moment in everyone's life is captured in film. And we should point out that although we see your mother's decline on screen, and it is incredibly difficult to watch and confronting, nonetheless, this is a film that she very much wanted to be made. In fact, this is a film that exists, really, because your mother wanted you to make it, right?
That's right, yeah. We told her that we wanted to make a documentary a long time ago when she was still compos mentis, and she was always really interested in speaking out about Huntington's, and she was the president of the local Huntington's Disease Association in Wellington in New Zealand. And she, every time there was a Huntington's Disease Awareness Week, she would try to get on the radio and tell everyone about it. When she found out that she had the gene, she put a note on the notice board at the school where she worked to say that she had the gene. I guess she figured that it was better for people to know, because then they can try and help you. And actually, the film's been incredible. We've had people really rally around us, you know, and I think we need that as part of my plan. My plan is that when I found out we all three had it, I didn't know what to do, and I didn't know how to communicate to the world that this was happening. It's kind of like you're drowning and no one's noticing.
So, Jeff, as a film, this is a piece of campaigning in a sense, really, isn't it? Campaigning in that you're really trying to increase awareness of this condition, because public awareness of Huntington's disease is very, very low indeed.
Yes, it is. And I think you may have mentioned before, quite often people just don't know what it is. They confuse it with other conditions. And so it makes it difficult to get empathy or support from the public and also to raise funding for research. But what's most important is that the people or families who are dealing with this don't have support. They don't have the empathy of communities around them. So that's a big motivation for us. We want to enlighten the community and help people who are in this situation, have people rally around them and support them. Because quite often this condition is misinterpreted, quite often as someone who's drunk or has bipolar or depression. People can be scared of them. The Huntington's people can become quite disinhibited, so they can do some pretty crazy things.
Yeah. Give us some examples of the crazy things people can do, perhaps some of the crazy things you caught on camera.
Well, we're quite timid in what we show on the film. There were some quite scary moments.
That ended up on the cutting room floor?
Yeah. Well, and certainly you just wouldn't film. Judy had moments of delusions and hallucinations, and she disappeared and she was found in a building site by some and rushed to the hospital. She'd take her clothes off at inappropriate times.
Which is not uncommon with Huntington's disease.
No, she got into the shower with me, which is interesting.
I suppose you've got to laugh, really. I mean, what else can you do?
So that's the full gamut, and that's, you know, it's Judy's. It's different for every person who takes the Huntington's journey. So
I wonder whether there is another disease quite like this where, as you said, Bridget, if you have the gene, you have a 100% chance of getting the disease. I mean, obviously you're not a doctor or a scientist, but are there any other diseases that are actually like that? I did a program recently on Alzheimer's where screening processes for Alzheimer's and dementia have improved dramatically. In fact, there's a new screening test, I think, that's just come out of Melbourne University, which will make it even easier. But even then, you can have the pathology in your brain, but it may not manifest before you die. So you could find out now that you have the pathology in your brain, but, you know, it might not come on until you're 90, at which time you're 6 feet under. But Huntington's is not like that. Are there any other diseases that we know of that are like that?
Very few. Yeah. There are some, but very few that have the absolute that Huntington's has.
I'm not sure that we've actually described either the how it manifests itself, Huntington's, the range of symptoms, the life expectancy. Just give us an idea of what, because people are very confused about it. What is Huntington's?
So it is different for each person that has the gene. Their journey through Huntington's will be different in every case. So that originally it was kind of diagnosed by physical symptoms, and they would be interpreted as the first signs of Huntington's disease. So that would be jerky movements, loss of balance, cognitive problems, your inhibitions. But more recently, in the last 10 years, they've worked out that actually you have cognitive symptoms up to 12 years prior to your physical symptoms. So that could be loss of memory, decline in cognitive function, anxiety, depression.
All of which could exist anyway and not necessarily be an indication of Huntington's onset.
That's right.
That could do your head in too, couldn't it?
Yeah, well, Bridget would tell you that, you know, she has moments in the house or doing something at work where she'll drop something or be a bit clumsy or forget something, and immediately her mind goes to, oh, my God, am I getting Huntington's? Mm. Whereas, you know, for us, oh, my God, it's middle age, here we go. So, yeah, that's haunting. That's a haunting aspect of Huntington's that Bridget has to live with each day.
Bridget, few diseases have the inevitability of the onset of Huntington's as you face. How much of a burden is it for you to carry on a daily basis? Can you explain it to us? Are you able to explain?
I can. There were different stages after I found out that I had the gene. I think I went through a grieving process. Who knows what those stages are? The stages of grieving, they're like anger and, you know, you kind of go through all these different denial, anger, blah, blah. So that was for quite a few years. I've settled into a state now where I go in and out of what I guess you should call denial. I've been trying to turn it into something else. I really have, but it's just denial, and I slip into, and it's really nice. It's a really nice place. In the documentary, I do come across as someone who's very, very strong and brave. And I can be strong and brave, but it just seems to be ever-changing, like this thing that you just keep trying to approach from different angles, and it just keeps not being processable.
Does it feel like a burden that you carry all of the time or not?
I think it just makes me anxious and makes me try to work out why we die. I wrestle with that a lot. And when I wake up in the middle of the night, when my brain is raw, you know, like what it's like when you wake up in the middle of the night and all your worries kind of flood into your head or whatever. So mine, I get Huntington's straight away and I try to wrestle with the reality of that. And I think the great thing about having perhaps a 80% chance of having a disease or a even 90% chance of having
cling.
A disease,
you can
yeah, you totally go to that 10%.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you're like, I'm going to be in that 10%. So I'm a really positive person, but Huntington's keeps doing my head in. So I think, it doesn't feel like a heavy burden. It feels like a kind of a psychologically kind of torturing thing that I wrestle with. But what I do is I just try to fight back with meditation and being present in the moment. And I have to do that a lot, which does make my life more special. And I had a 17-year-old girl ask me yesterday. She came up and her dad's dying of Huntington's. He's in his 40s. And she said, you know, well, actually, her grandma said, look, can you please, you know, tell us how you're so brave? Because she needs, you know, she says that Huntington's has ruined her life, which I think is fair enough to say. You know, I said to her, what is really great about being from a Huntington's family is that you actually have an incredible strength. You might not have discovered it yet, but it will inevitably rise to the surface, you know.
Well, it comes through with your family on film, definitely. So there's no sense with you that your life is divided into two halves, the half that existed before you found out that you had Huntington's and after, because you're captured on film feeling confident or telling us that you were utterly confident that despite the 50% chance that you wouldn't have the gene. Is that just the positive side of your character, you think, coming to the fore?
Yeah. I actually thought we were a lucky family. And we still think we're a lucky family, ironically. So I just thought, well, Mum had it. I can't have it because that's like two, you know,
it's not
two strikes against
exactly.
us. So, of course, when I had the gene test, I thought, well, that's that. I've got it. My brothers won't have it. So then when my first brother found out that he had it, I got really physically angry in the room that I was in and just yelled and screamed. And you know, he had this great attitude to it. He was okay. And then we made lots of jokes for the next couple of years about how the other brother would be able to look after us and how he was going to have to do everything. And it was really hilarious. And then he ended up having the test. So now we... you know, having the test and having the genes. So now we make the same joke about poor Jeff here.
Filmmaker Bridget Lyon, who has the Huntington's gene, meaning it's inevitable she'll get the disease. She had a 50% chance of having it passed on to her from her mother, as did her brothers. How cruel, then, that she and all her siblings are destined to get the disease. I'm also talking tonight with Bridget's partner, Jeff McDonald. Together, they've made the documentary The Inheritance, which we're discussing tonight on Big Ideas, on RN, online and on your mobile. Here's a little more from the film.
As Mum's symptoms crept up on her, I found my test results had left me feeling guilty for my child's future. As an HD family, we had been inextricably linked to scientists studying the disease. My mum had been friends with the visionary neuroscientist Professor Fall for many years. He's the director of the Centre for Brain Research in Auckland, where they study Huntington's brains.
So what is really interesting about Huntington's disease is that it causes cells to die in their millions in the area called the basal ganglia. It's right in the centre of the brain.
Along with Professor Fall, scientists all around the world had been working passionately on understanding Huntington's for decades. Their progress was gathering momentum.
The really difficult thing with Huntington's disease and the Huntington protein, it does a lot of bad things.
Proteins cluster together, so they become kind of sticky, like glue, so they form these very small balls inside the nerve cells inside the brain.
It's a bit like pouring cement inside a brain cell, which causes the brain cells to die.
It's more than a disease of the brain, I would say.
A little audio from the documentary The Inheritance. Let's return to my conversation with Bridget Lyon and Jeff McDonald. What's the best case scenario for yourself?
Oh, yeah, there is a best case scenario.
Let's talk about the best case scenario.
Yeah. So we are in a situation where science is making leaps and bounds and we are kind of leaping and bounding towards Huntington's. So it's kind of a little bit of a race. I had one of the most prominent Huntington's scientists in the world hold my hands and say, your experience of Huntington's will be different to your mother's experience of Huntington's. And you could tell he'd kind of, you know, this was what he said to people. And I did take heart from it that there'll be some more treatments as we go along. The treatments are improving and improving. So, well, what we can do is say if you get the first symptoms of depression or something, well, obviously you can have antidepressant medication. If you have hallucinations, you can have an antipsychotic medication, which are actually amazing. You can cut out so much stuff without actually totally taking away someone's personality, which is great, better than 50 years ago. They also have some medications, not really awesome ones, but some that, well, they're okay to stop the movements, the jerky movements and the balance problems. So, yeah, that's our kind of situation. Best case scenario is something that I'll get Jeff to tell you about that he read about the other day.
And is there an average age of onset?
There is an average age.
That's not terribly helpful, really, knowing the average, because it can...
Yeah, well, it's 35 to 45 is the average, but we've met people recently who are getting it at 20, and we've seen footage of people of kids with it. So it generally has a family onset average. Mm. In Bridget's family, it's a bit later, so it is late 40s. But that's not to say that they won't get it earlier. You know, you can look at the average but not actually be sure. Yeah, so as a universal average, it's 35 to 45.
So have you spoken to the kids about this? Yeah. I mean, they're running around in front of us
now,
as we speak. They're young boys. Is it possible to have a conversation?
We do have a conversation. Yeah. They've expressed their joy of not having it.
Yep.
And Finn has expressed his fears of having it.
Yep.
They're both very sympathetic to us. And, you know, they've been very, very patient with us making this. And they look after their gran. They live with it. They see it every day, or almost every day, and they're great.
And this is a terrible question to ask. How often do you wonder about whether your son has the gene? I mean, it's a pointless thing to worry about, but does it creep into the back of your mind from time to time?
Very occasionally. I have to say I'm quite confident that in his lifetime he just won't. It won't be a thing he has to grapple with as a terminal point for him. By then, I think we will just be able to repress the symptoms long enough that he has to worry about other things.
And this is because we have seen a trajectory of medical improvement, that if it continues at the same trajectory, you can hold that confidence?
Correct. But that's a very recent trajectory. So they went for 25 years with very little advancement. Only in the last probably 2 or 3 years have they had quite a steep curve of discovery. But like Bridget's brother Nick points out in the documentary, that with the discovery, they actually discover that it's way more complex than they thought as well. So they thought it just affected the brain, but now they know that it affects other physiology in the body. And by actually just treating the brain, they might not actually treat the whole disease. So... It's a quality of life thing, you know.
Yeah.
We're all going to be got by something. So it's all about maintaining a quality of life. Yeah.
So Huntington's in Tasmania is exceptionally prevalent, one of the highest prevalence rates in the world. Why is that?
Second highest in the world. Essentially isolated populations, it tends to happen in. And also the migration patterns. So in New Zealand, the migration pattern was from Scotland, where there was a lot of Huntington's disease, and it seems that it happened there. I think it's a similar thing for Tasmania, although not many people, I don't think, moved out of Tasmania initially, so I think it was centralised here for a little while. But yeah, it's interesting that it does, because of all the countries in the world, the most prevalent country is in Venezuela, a small town in Venezuela where there's 17,000 people with Huntington's disease, and it's absolutely stricken with poverty. The government does very little to support them. But it's actually where Huntington's was discovered as well.
Mm.
So the scientists from the US went there and did an in-depth study. And
where is your mother at now in her decline, I suppose, is the only way to put it?
We finished filming that a year ago. Mm. And at the end of the film, she can blow out the candles on her birthday cake, just, with lots of help. She can't talk anymore. She's having trouble swallowing. She's pretty much stuck in bed, although sometimes they bring her out, put her in her chair. What happens in late stage Huntington's is that the movements stop, so you become rigid. So they've just put her on a medication to try to make her be able to bend her to bathe her, but it's made her so floppy that now her neck flops about, her head flops about on her neck. So that's kind of the latest challenge. So what happens throughout Huntington's is that you try to fix one thing and something else will go wrong. That happens a lot. Yeah, so we don't know how much longer she's got. So we've had lots of discussions about her end of life with palliative carers, nurses, experts, and they're actually quite remarkable. They're amazing because they deal with this stuff all the time. So stuff that you might find talking about might be taboo or something, they can really kind of take you through and make it seem like less difficult decisions, because they'll tell you stuff like that. You, when you talk about not resuscitating, that sounds really terrifying, but when they say, well, actually her standard of life after that kind of a trauma would be, very, very, very small. So
yeah.
It's about making decisions like that, but they make it a lot easier.
So making the film, does that help you deal with what you're going through with your mother? I mean, it's a heartbreaking thing to witness, but I wonder whether the discipline of also being in the filmmaking process makes it easier for you to process, because there's something else that's going on that you have to focus on, and that is telling the story on camera.
I think that it's actually been quite empowering for our family. My dad didn't have anything else going on except mum, and so in after the film has been made, has probably been quite incredible for him. He's been in at some of the Q&As and people have applauded him and told him how amazing he is, and he's been able to give inspiration to people who are caring for other people for long periods of time without that person kind of responding, giving any kind of response back to them. A lot of people have drawn strength from him, which he hadn't really been able to do when he was at home just by himself with no one knowing what he was doing. So that's probably been the best thing about it, has been that part of the process. The actual filmmaking was just sometimes torturous, because when I edit things, I it gets into my head all day, and I edited a documentary series on sentencing for murder last year, and so then I started thinking I was going to be murdered, and then I was working on the Huntington's documentary as well, and then I thought, well, I knew I was going to get Huntington's, but I thought I was getting it that day. It was all over that day.
The other thing, you were talking about your mother's palliative care. Your older brother talks explicitly about not going through the later stages of Huntington's that your mother is currently going through, and he quite really directly and bluntly says on camera, don't think he uses the word euthanasia, but that's essentially what he says. And I have to say, I can understand him making that call, but nonetheless, filming him and seeing him say that must have come as a bit of a shock to you.
And that was literally the first time he'd told me about that. I said, let's do a Skype call, I'm recording this. And then he straight out came out with it, and it really shocked me. But it's quite a common thing for people in this situation to talk about. We've had a few discussions about it since then, and he seems just really sure that he wants to go that way. I don't think I could cope with that happening, but different people have different kind of senses of control, and I think perhaps once you've had kids, you're kind of used to not having control. So, and you're used to kind of having, I guess, looking at your kids and getting a sense of joy just by looking at them. So I think that perhaps if I was sitting around with later stage Huntington's, as long as I could see my kids, I think that would be some kind of quality of life. There's all these questions that we think about all the time, think about all the time, and things like not being religious and yet not having a brain that can in any way comprehend how you end this life thing, because it's actually really cool. It's really amazing, and it's really full of amazing stuff. Like, it's incredible, and I don't see how that ends. I know there's lots of religions who are happy to give you, options for that, but they don't kind of work for me. I wish I had like a brain like some kind of genius, and I would suddenly understand one day what the deal is. So yeah, that's probably what.
So you really do ponder the meaning of it all.
I do. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see how you do it. How could you not? Make sense.
Yeah. And to the film itself, what's been the response from the Huntington's community, from those people working in the area? I mean, they must be extremely grateful that you've done this, because, I mean, I don't know, I've never seen a film like this. I'm not sure that anyone's made a film like this before about Huntington's.
They are extremely appreciative of us sharing our story, because a lot of people in the situation don't have the opportunity to share it. They don't have the skills to create a visual story. The medical fraternity is really happy about having something like this. We've had lots of requests to make it available to education and community support. And in fact, the Tasmanian government representative that came to see it yesterday wants to show it to the government. And we had the same request in New Zealand. And there has been other documentaries made in the US only. Mm. So this is probably the first Southern Hemisphere documentary, and maybe we're hoping to show it in Europe as well. Mm. But the response has been great. We've had a lot of support and a lot of people personally thanking us for helping others understand Huntington's people.
Mm.
Yep. A lot of support workers didn't know how to look after Huntington's people. They just didn't get it.
Yeah.
And you'd think, oh, well, they're nurses and doctors. You'd think they'd have the training. But no, they really find this documentary quite enlightening.
Has it been a therapeutic process? It sounds like it has been for Bridget. What about for you?
Yeah, I'm pretty Buddhist about everything. So things are just the way they are, and you deal with it. That's how I do it. But I see it having been a great therapy for the family. Definitely brought them closer together. We just did screenings together where the whole family turned up, and it's quite amazing to watch the family united, and they're quite remarkable and powerful.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's been my emotional journey, watching a family unite and bond. It's pretty special.
So, Bridget, you make the film, and, of course, the film's about you and your family, but in your case especially about you. This is an intimate, personal journey, and you're a quiet, retiring type who I'm sure would prefer not to be in the spotlight. How do you feel about having to come out and talk about what's obviously something more than just a film? It's your future. How hard is it for you to do? And how ironic is it that you find yourself in this position?
There's that Woody Allen quote that the secret of success is just to turn up. So I just keep doing that.
Yeah.
I just keep turning up and answering questions, and I find myself turning from being Bridget the editor and Bridget the mother into Bridget the Huntington's disease advocate. Mm. So I'm struggling with my new identity, but it is really good, because it's been remarkable to meet new, you know, people have come up to me after screenings and saying, "Hi, my mother died of it, my father died of a broken heart. Now my nephew, you know, I don't have the gene, but my nephews are now getting it," you know. So you meet these people and actually suddenly your story is normal to them.
Mm.
And I didn't know anyone else kind of like me before. Meeting people who've got really a lot of repeats. So if you have I have 42 or 43 repeats of the mutation. If you have over 50, you're going to get it when you're really young. And I met a girl the other day who was 24 and symptomatic, trying to have a child with IVF. She, you know, she has 51 repeats, and you just, you know, it's like she saunters along. She says, "Hi, my name's, I've got 51 repeats," and we all just look back at her like, "Oh no, what do you say to that?" You know. So, I guess meeting people whose lives are wiped out at the age of 25 or whatever is gives me perspective. Yeah, and so it's been really good for me. But part of why I wanted to do this was because I thought perhaps we would all die and no one would notice, and I wanted people to know what was happening to our family. But we're going to get it maybe in our mid-40s or mid-50s, whereas a lot of people get it in their, you know, can get it in their 20s. There's a woman in the film who's of five siblings. None of them have made it to 50. They've all kind of died in their, you know, got it in early 40s and be dead by 50. So that was a big part of making the film, was because we can actually, we have the resources to tell the story, and we're not symptomatic yet, so we can actually still use our brains to do this thing.
Yeah, look, it's a cliche to say that this is a brave documentary, but in this case it is absolutely the case. Incredible bravery on both of your parts from different perspectives, and I thank you very much for coming along today and sharing this story with us. It is absolutely incredible documentary, the type of which, once you've seen it, you never forget it. Thanks a lot for coming along, and good luck with the journey ahead, both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
That conversation with Bridget Lyon and Jeff McDonald about The Inheritance, their documentary on Huntington's disease, took place at the Festival Lounge at the Breath of Fresh Air Tasmanian Film Festival in Launceston. The Inheritance has had a limited number of screenings. For information about how to view the film and other details, you can visit the film's website. There's a link to it on our webpage, abc.net.au/rn/bigideas. On Big Ideas, we're going to quite dramatically change gears now and examine the invention, no less, of modern science. This year sees the 400th anniversary of the birth of Dr. John Wilkins, the warden of Wadham College at the University of Oxford. He convened the founders of the Royal Society and created a unique environment for scientific innovation. To celebrate this anniversary, we now hear from Oxford mathematician Professor Marcus de Sautoy, talking about the invention of modern science and the joy of math.
The inspiration for today's event is, of course, the 400th anniversary of John Wilkins, the sixth warden of Wadham. I was also an undergraduate at Wadham College, but I must say that my first encounter with Warden Wilkins was by rather a roundabout route. I think one of the great things about Oxford is that when you come up as an undergraduate, you spend a lot of time talking to people from many different subjects. So I fell in with a set of people at Wadham that were doing Persian and Arabic and philosophy, politics and economics, literary theory. And we would sit around at night discussing the things that we did. And I felt it was important for me to try and explain why mathematics was as exciting as deconstructing Henry James or reading Omar Khayyam's Rumiyat. Now, I think that the other undergraduates who are doing sciences alongside me had a slightly easier job than mathematics. I think most people kind of get what a geneticist does when they're looking down the microscope looking at cells, or an astrophysicist when they're looking at the telescopes at the early universe. But what on earth, or perhaps not on earth, a mathematician is doing is still something of a mystery. So I would spend a lot of time trying to explain to people why I thought mathematics was as important as trying to crack cancer or trying to understand the origins in the early universe of where we came from. And my own research is in the world of symmetry. And symmetry is obviously incredibly important to many of the sciences. If you're a geneticist or you're studying viruses, many viruses have a very symmetrical shape, and understanding that can give you some insight into the virus. Understanding breaking symmetry at the beginning of the universe helps us to understand how particles interact with the fundamental forces. When I finished as an undergraduate, a very important theorem had been proved in mathematics about symmetry. We'd come up with essentially a periodic table which gives us the building blocks, the atoms from which all symmetries are built. And for me, this classification was the beginning of my own research, which I spent a lot of time trying to put these atoms together to try and see what the molecules of symmetry are like. So classification is a very important theme in the work that I do as a mathematician, trying to understand what's out there and when you've understood it all. I realised that I'd made some progress trying to explain to my fellow undergraduates one day when, as a graduate, still at Wadham, a colleague of mine, a friend who did English, and she'd stayed on to do her PhD, suddenly threw down on the table on my mathematics a book. And she said, "This sounds a bit like what you keep on saying maths is all about." And what she was pointing at was an article by Foucault. And it was actually, he was describing how he'd laughed out loud at a quote by Borges. Borges had come up with a fictional Chinese encyclopedia which tried to classify animals. And I'd like you to read you this classification, because in some way it really did sum up, I think, what I was doing as a mathematician, and translates it into, well, as I agree with Foucault, it is quite a humorous classification. So this is Borges's Chinese encyclopedia. Animals are divided into A, belonging to the emperor, B, embalmed, C. Tame. D. Sucking pigs. E. Sirens. F. Fabulous. G. Stray dogs. H. Included in the present classification. I. Frenzied. J. Innumerable. K. Drawn with a fine camel hair brush. L. Etc. M. Having just broken the water pitcher. N. That from a long way off looked like flies. Now the quote encapsulated me for perfectly what it was I was trying to do, to try and classify and sort the sort of world around me into some sort of order. And in fact, that quote, that the article where Borges came up with this Chinese encyclopedia, although that was a fictional classification, actually what he wanted to describe was a classification, a means of classification that John Wilkins came up with. And the author was called The Analytic Language of John Wilkins. So it was a very curious, circuitous route that I went from Foucault to Borges, finally to encounter Ward and Wilkins for the first time. Now, Borges described how Wilkins attempted to try and classify everything in the whole universe using a new language. So he started by dividing everything up into 40 different categories. And each of these categories he assigned a two-letter monosyllable. And gradually he would try and divide everything until you could identify everything in the universe with this language. So, for example, the word debar, John Wilkins' word debar, the D-E denotes one of the 40 categories, meaning an element. B means it's the first element, which at the time was fire. A, the last letter, meant that it was part of that element. So debar was John Wilkins' word for flame. And so in this way, he hoped to develop a language that he could classify the whole of the universe. Now, this wasn't just some academic exercise, because it went very much to the heart of what Ward and Wilkins believed, which is we should find a way, a common language, to be able to communicate the great ideas of science. And this was his attempt to create a language which we could communicate science to the whole public. And it was actually in this spirit that I think Wilkins and his colleagues founded the Royal Society, as much to make great discoveries, but also to communicate and try and get science being dialogued and tell people about the wonderful breakthroughs of science. So he wrote some wonderful books, including one which I especially like, called Mathematical Magic. In these books, he talks about flying chariots that he hoped would take us to the moon, to be able to meet the moon folk that would be up there. He talked about perpetual motion machines, which he hoped would solve our energy crisis. He was also a man of the Baroque. He's talked about illusions, experiments with automata that could talk, magical lanterns that could make rainbows, and the architecture full of drama and surprise. Now, I think Ward and Wilkins would love to come back today and see what's going on in the scientific world at the moment. I think we're living in a kind of new Baroque period. The 21st century is the new Baroque. He would come back and he would discover these wonderful things called iPhones, on which there was kind of like artificial intelligence embedded into these things. He'd go to the cinema and see amazing artificial worlds created in front of him. He would walk around the cities and see the extraordinary landscape that we've built using the power of mathematics to somehow defy the laws of physics. And mathematics truly is at the heart of much of the technology that is so exciting today. Okay, well, maybe we didn't meet moon folk when we went to the moon, but I think he would be very excited to see that we'd use our science actually to get to the moon. And perhaps our physics today explains that a perpetual motion machine ain't going to be possible. But certainly trying to solve the energy crisis will be using all of the ideas, the scientific method that John Wilkins believed was going to be the future for humanity. And I think John Wilkins would also found his belief in the importance of communicating scientific breakthroughs to society is still at the heart of the ethos of the Royal Society. Actually, the Royal Society is partly responsible for where I am today. I'm a professor of mathematics here at the University of Oxford, making new discoveries about mathematics. But I'm also the Simony Professor for the Public Understanding of Science, trying to find new and innovative ways to try and communicate these great breakthroughs to society. So for me, this kind of encapsulates what being a scientist is about. It's about discovery, but also communication. Unless you communicate the idea and bring it alive in the minds of others, then it hardly can be said to exist. I must admit, actually, though, when I first started thinking about trying to communicate scientific ideas to the public 20 years ago as a postdoc fellow in All Souls College, I did it with some trepidation. I wrote, I remember, an article for the Times about the Fields Medal winners that had won that year and about the great breakthroughs they'd made. Now, 20 years ago, nobody knew what a Fields Medal was. It was before Good Will Hunting, and so Matt Damon had not explained what a Fields Medal was. But I thought it was important to explain to society what our great breakthrough was. This is our Nobel Prize of mathematics, and it never got talked about. But I must admit, 20 years ago, the thought of a scientist writing for the newspapers was rather looked down upon. I actually became a mathematician because of a particular book that my maths teacher, I went to school just locally here at Comprehensive School, just outside Oxford, and my maths teacher recommended a lovely little book called A Mathematician's Apology. It's a beautiful book about the creative art of being a mathematician. And it really inspired me. I came up, I remember, that weekend when he'd recommended it, and I went to Blackwell's just across the road here and bought the copy of this book, and I still have it today. But actually, I want to read you the first sentence of this book, because it's not really much encouragement for any mathematician wanting to tell their stories to the public. It is a melancholy experience for a professional mathematician to find himself writing about mathematics. The function of a mathematician is to do something. To prove new theorems, to add to mathematics, and not to talk about what he or other mathematicians have done. So it was under this spectre that 20 years ago, you know, it was mathematicians and scientists were meant to get on with their job. Science was pretty isolated from society, and it caused a lot of problems. Over the last 20 years, we've seen how much science has impacted on society. Climate change, how we're going to address that, the decisions we'll have to make about new energies, is it going to be nuclear, is it going to be other energies which will have their own impact on society? Stem cells, you know, each government has made different decisions about how they're going to use stem cells in research. Genetically modified crops, how, you know, that could solve a lot of problems, but it could also introduce new problems. So it's incredibly important for a society to actually understand the impact that their science is going to have on them. John Wilkins' belief in the importance of communicating science in plain English to society beyond the confines of the scholarly community is probably more relevant today than it was in Wilkins' time in the 17th century. I think it's only by understanding the science that we can be empowered. We are disenfranchised. We cannot have that debate about stem cells if we don't understand what a stem cell is. So, for me, it's incredibly important that actually the Royal Society is really embodying today the ethos that I think Wilkins believed in. We should make scientific discoveries, but we should also find ways to engage society with those problems. Just after I wrote that first article for the Times, I became a university research fellow at the Royal Society. And I was a little bit nervous. I wrote another article, and I thought maybe they'll sort of tell me I shouldn't be doing this. But I got a huge amount of encouragement from the Royal Society saying, no, this is an important role for a scientist to play, which is why I've ended up with these dual roles of being a professor of maths and the professor for the public understanding of science. So in a way, I still carry on, as I did as an undergraduate in my rooms in Wadham, telling my mathematical stories, not to my fellow undergraduates, but to as many people as will listen to them. Wilkins' message that scientific knowledge is not the preserve of the scientific elite, but should be open to all levels of society, is as pertinent in this 400th anniversary as it was in the 17th century. The scientists that made up Wilkins' scientific club that became the Royal Society changed the world. Today, the scientific community is revolutionising modern life. It's important that those scientists that are involved in this revolution step up to the plate, and just as Wilkins did, tell their stories to a society that will be transformed by these new ideas.
Professor of Mathematics, Marcus de Sautoy, on maths as the driving force behind modern science. Thanks to Oxford University for this recording. That's it for Big Ideas tonight. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
They're waiting for future catastrophe.
Anyone who prepares by definition is a prepper.
They're not all doomsday obsessives, but they're influenced by social media.
Just being able to see how often disasters happen makes people realize it really can happen to them too.
Meet the Prepper Movement on Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.